Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Little echo chamber of you and I and the people in the network and stuff like that.
Speaking of the network,
UHP Plus going live. Yeah, UHP Plus, the membership subscription version of what we ended up building with the UHP network is going live this week, tomorrow, actually, which will be the 31st of May.
Yeah.
First full week will be Monday. That's the first. Wait, no, Monday's the 3rd. Okay.
Yep.
Monday, June 3rd. So if you're listening to this around then, you can still get in at the promotional rate that we have for the early access people. If you would like to try to jump in on that. Yeah. It's quite a big savings. So if you are interested in that, head to the website. Today we're going to talk about, so on the network, we post a question or poll to see if people had anything that they wanted to talk about on the podcast and things that they hear a lot from clients and patients and colleagues. And someone had mentioned something about rolling and different types of like body awareness, body mapping techniques. And, you know, that when you think about a lot of this stuff, you think about like Tai Chi, you think about the work of like Moshe Feldenkrais, you think about Frederick Alexander, I believe was the guy that came up with the whole in the 1800s, the whole Alexander technique.
Yeah.
Which is like center of gravity, base of support, center of mass, positioning of joints. Yeah. We can even get into like a little bit of that. There's some other schools of thought, and
you have to throw PNF in there because
PNF, Cabot-Boss.
Yeah, but see, like, you know, people look at PNF and then they associate it with like stretching because it got categorized as PNF. It's like PNF is an entire system of treatment and training. People don't really realize that.
And
rolling is in there, right?
Yeah, rolling
for a reason. I think for a reason.
Center of gravity and center of like, what's it called? Instantaneous center of rotation. Is that right? Is that what they call it?
They will make reference to that when they're talking about joint positions and movements. Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that was something that Shirley Sarman would write about a lot. So that comes to mind. I think points of instantaneous center of rotation is something that I took from reading her work. Yeah. So I was talking about base support. Mm-hmm. Points of instantaneous center of rotation, which is actually a really cool concept because it's talking about like a joint, how something rotates within the center of a joint and how that position changes over time. So it is sort of like a four-dimensional representation of joint position, if you perceive it that way.
It is somewhat useful as a descriptor. It's kind of like looking at joints as levers. It's like, is it useful as a descriptor? It helps us create a picture, but is it accurate? Probably not.
Yeah.
Because then people are chasing things, like they're saying, "Oh, we have to get the we have to get it in this position only." And it's like the joint sort of takes care of itself if you have access to all of the if you have access to all of the motions that should be available. It's like it takes care of itself. It's not something that you have to. You can't measure it, really.
Right.
You can't measure it, so don't worry about it so much. I tend to not spend a lot of time worrying about things that I don't have an accurate measure for. That's why I got a list of dirty words that I just don't use because they're not helpful. But if we want to get back to the topic at hand, right? It's like, why are we spending all this time on the ground? For a very good reason. Because when we talk about movement, we talk about shape changes, and a lot of situations arise where through repeated behaviors, stress, trying to control your center of gravity in the midst of compensatory activity, we lose the capacity for shape change. And then we lose the ability to produce sensations on our own. And so that's one of the reasons why we rely on certain types of exercises, certain positions that we might use. But the cool thing is that with rolling, we're getting a whole slew of sensations that we normally would not be exposed to. And then that provides us opportunities to change that we right. wouldn't normally get. And so, yeah, so that's why it's so important.
Yeah. So and there are a lot of reasons why rolling has. So I think what we should try to get into a little bit is like the traditional reasons and the approaches that are taken by people in the past who have used rolling. Because, you know, when I learned about rolling, it was like segmental rolling and doing a certain progression of lower body rolling and then upper body rolling and then switching that. And mm-hmm. that model that I now think back toward the model that I learned is like not giving that same sort of progression to everybody for the reasons that they were being given. It doesn't really mm-hmm. make that much sense. So I guess maybe we talk about like the traditional representation of segmental rolling and then what's actually happening, because we're trying to get people to reconsider what they already think they know about rolling, right?
Right. Well, it's not random, first yeah. of all. It's not like, and we always fall into these categorizations in the rehab and fitness industries of everybody needs to be able to do X. And not yes. everybody can, right? Because we're all idiosyncratic in our ability to access certain movements and positions. So there's going to be certain types of activities that will be ideal. And I don't know that there is like a traditional necessarily, other than say something that would be along the lines of classic physical education, martial arts has, like every martial art will have some exposure to ground-based contacts, because you got to be able to fall, you got to be able to absorb energy from the ground and such, which again, this is teaching you to shape change, because if you can't change shape change and you do hit the ground, tends to result in bad things, right? Too much load, too much stress in one place, and you get injured. So rolling has always been a part of that. But again, we talk about like early propulsion being a phase of propulsion where we're actually absorbing energy. It's like, this is actually why I talk about propulsion, because rolling has to follow the same rules, right? So as we're rolling, we're actually absorbing and releasing energy. We're distributing load. So we talk about the distributed yield associated with running, walking, and such. It's like the same thing is happening when we're talking about rolling behaviors on the ground. Right. And so that has always been part of it. Now, not described that way, but it does follow the exact same principles as we would say yeah. any other form of propulsion.
I'm trying to take a step back and try to think back to the reasons why, when I was introduced to the concepts of like segmental rolling, why they're being used. A lot of it is like cross connection of the upper and lower half, being able to try to get dynamic stability back in single leg stance. So like if you're stepping over something or walking, something like that. And then usually having that correlate to some form of like quadruped stability test or something. I'm thinking about a lot of that from that perspective.
Yeah. Anytime you use the S word, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get to middle P.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
Anything outside of that is an external rotation bias. And then you're superimposing various degrees of internal rotation and then applying force to the ground and then moving the center of gravity ahead of the point of contact. We don't have to talk about anything funny other than the fact that, okay, your center of mass is on the ground. It's going to be in a certain position relative to the ground contact. Okay. So for me to roll in a direction, I have to actually move my center mass over the point of contact and then get ahead of it, just like taking a step forward. So that's why rolling follows the same rules of propulsion, but it's the shape changing that is most important, because it's the exact same shape changes that you would make if you're walking across the ground. What okay. people don't seem to recognize is like, this is why we talk about foot contact being so important. It's like, if I get the right foot contacts, I get the behaviors of creating the energy absorption phase, the force production phase into the ground, and then the energy releasing phase that would be in late propulsion.
Yeah. Right? I mean, if you think about heel to ankle to toe rocker, if you know that model of thinking of the foot, that is a roll. It's just on each foot.
It is a roll. It's exactly the same thing.
Each foot roll is just like you would roll on your side.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So again, all we're talking about is the ability to access relative motion, the ability to produce force into the ground, and the ability to propel yourself forward at a higher rate of velocity. That's literally the same thing. And so what if I am working with an individual and they can't produce those sensations on their own that allows them to change the shape? I would do, as a therapist, I can do manual therapies and promote I can provide them with those sensations. I can make those changes. We can recapture the relative motions that give them the capacity to absorb energy, produce force, and then release energy. But then how do they do that themselves? So this is why we do activities on the ground. This is why we use different positions. If you look at right side lying from a positional standpoint, it is partway through a roll.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm accessing a certain element of that. Now I look at what is the precursor to that position? Like, where would I have to be to eventually rest, apply force down into that position? And so this is when we're talking about short arc lazy rolling from sideline. It's like I'm moving through a very small excursion of a roll, because what I'm trying to do is I'm actually trying to promote a progressive shape change. If I try to do too much too soon, just like any other activity, so if I try to run before I can walk, that kind of concept, right? I won't be able to make the appropriate shape changes that I need to be able to access the movements that I want to be able to access.
All right. So I'm going to give an example here. So Bill's talking about shape change. And if you just think about like a lump of clay or dough that you're trying to roll out on the table, if I have someone that's compressed from front to back, that looks mm-hmm. like that, and mm-hmm. then I put them on their side, I can get that space to come back to allow for what Bill's talking about, the space to put force down into the ground.
Correct.
So if I need to create the space in order which to put down force and IR down within my base of support, so there each person's max P is where it's supposed to be. Put that on a T-shirt. Is your max P where it's supposed to be? Maybe that'll be one of the shirts that we have in the store that nobody will buy.
It'll be right there with two steps forward, one step
forward. Yeah. So maybe we'll start making memes on the UHP network.
There you go.
But yeah, so that's what, when Bill's talking about shape change, when Bill's talking about like that middle position, we're trying to allow for the ground to help create the space.
Right.
Because
that's what the ground does anyway. Yeah.
Because we eliminate a lot of the effect of gravity that you would have on 2 feet.
Correct. It we are distributing the stress. We are creating sensations that promote the same shape changes that would happen in upright. See, that's the thing that you want to recognize. It's like, why would I roll around the ground? It's like, because ultimately I want to be up on my 2 feet and still be able to access relative motions, still be able to produce force into the ground, and still be able to release energy. But that requires that this shape change. And so we pick roles that produce the same strategies that we would use upright. And so if you look at, you know, something as simple as some of the arm bar variations, all they are is steps forward. Right.
Yeah.
With a different ground contact. So the energy is distributed in a different manner, but it still produces the exact same shapes that I would use to move across the ground if I was standing up and moving on my feet. It's still the same shape change that I would use if I was swimming. That's why the language is funny, right? That's why we call things propulsion, because when we're talking about propulsion, we're talking about the exact same rules, right? ER biases, superimposition of internal rotation, yielding actions of connective tissues. That's the energy absorption phase, right? More internal rotation, more compression, more force into the ground. That's more of the middle propulsive phase. Then I move back towards ER with a reducing amount of IR and a higher velocity as I'm moving in a direction. Those are the late propulsive strategies. All we're talking about is rolling. Okay. Now we have different axes of roles, because we have different internal behaviors that we have to account for. So if we're talking about, say, a dorsal sacral roll, where we're actually on our back rolling from head to tail, right? we have internal behaviors that have to, that the internal dynamics have to be able to move upward and downward inside of the axial skeleton. And so if we need to emphasize that element, now we understand like which type of role that we need to start with under that circumstance. So if the vertical component is more important, I'm rolling on my long axis versus rolling straight sideways over the long axis. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then again, depending on what type of an activity that we're doing. So if we were working on changes of direction, like cutting activities, okay, the vertical component of that is reduced relative to jumping up and down or sprinting. Under that circumstance, the internal dynamics have a more up and down, a more vertical component. So we wouldn't use roles like a shoulder roll or something would be more horizontal necessarily to because it doesn't emphasize the same internal dynamics. So we can be coherent with our programs depending on what the goal is. If I'm working with a sprinter on top speed, I might use certain types of roles on the long axis. Generally speaking, for certain elements of like ground contacts and things like that, but from the internal dynamic standpoint, it's more vertically oriented. It's more straight up and down, right?
Yeah. So let's elaborate on that.
I can create a conflict by using the wrong roles at the wrong time.
So let's build a for instance. So we've got a 200 meter runner who's got some like Achilles based issues when they start. Every time they come out of the blocks, they feel. So that person is probably being shoved very far forward, and then they're outside of their base of support, and that sort of they've lost enough of the space to put stuff down into the ground, and now they're getting this like undue twisting at the Achilles and the heel.
At the Achilles, correct.
Okay,
right.
So if I gave that person front to back rolling only. Or if I gave that person only one type of rolling, I could potentially make it worse or better. And let's maybe talk about like how. Let's talk about those two scenarios.
Okay, so let's use a vertical and an oblique.
Yes.
Okay, so if I was trying to secure a stronger ground contact in internal rotation. On this, let's just say it's a right Achilles. Fair? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to secure more internal rotation, so more straight down into the ground under that circumstance. However, if I have, say, a compensatory external rotation strategy on that side, I know I don't have the internal rotation. So I know I don't have the shape that would allow the pelvis to then allow the hip to push straight down into the ground. So they're going to try to push into the ground with external rotation because it's going all the way to the ground. So I need to promote a shape change in the axial skeleton. We'll use the pelvis as our primary example here. Mm-hmm. And the way that I would do that is I have to put a downward pressure straight through the pelvis. So this would be straight down in right sideline would promote the IR shape of the pelvis. So we think about that being step one. If I can't push straight down, I would be in an ER'd position. That's going to take me away from midline as I try to push into the ground. All your best injuries come from people trying to push into the ground through an ER'd shape, right? I have too much external rotation. All your biceps, femoris, hamstring strains, all your sprained ankles, all your patellofemoral stuff. Those are all ER'd representations where people are trying to push into the ground, right? But if I use the ground and I use the force into the ground in sideline, I can actually promote the shape change. So you got your towel roll?
Yep.
So lay the flat towel roll first. I tip it up on side, and then that restores the AP dimension that gets me the internal rotation capacity back. So I've gone from a supine position where I was flat as a pancake front to back. I turn on my side. Now I get the anterior posterior expansion. I can now push into the ground.
So the superimposition. So if I was in right side lying, so just to kind of give people an example of that. So what they could potentially do in right side lying is have ground contact against a wall with their right foot, correct?
Yes.
to create the, to, if I have the medial aspect of the foot, I can then actually drive IR through that right side, which is now being given space and sideline. And then we, even in the recon program, we do things like step overs, which are a roll where you have that foot contact against the wall and you step through. So I've built it, like go backtracking a little bit, create the space and sideline, get the foot contacts. If they can't achieve the foot contacts, you might need to call in someone with manual skills to get the foot shape back, because it's just, we're shape changing the foot just like we would shape change the axial skeleton. And then the thing you could do to try to complete this intervention would be these step over type of drills that are rolling drills.
Right. You're actually stepping through middle propulsion in sideline. And it actually looks like you're taking a step forward. Right.
I'll throw a little video overlay on this while I'm doing that.
That'd be awesome. No, it's like you can see that we're actually stepping into an early representation. We're stepping through middle. There's where we're going to get our change in the AP diameter of the axial skeleton. And then we step through into the energy releasing position. So again, take a standing step forward, lay down on your side, and you have a roll. Like literally, that's what we're talking about under this circumstance. So again, this is why we would have to choose the appropriate activity to produce the appropriate shape.
So the hope would be at the end of this, if I had a 200 meter sprinter, right Achilles pain out of the blocks, I'm thinking that I don't really have the ability to put the IR down into the ground. So that's just this point that would mean that the point at which they're trying to force the IR into the ground would be at the Achilles, right? Instead of through the foot. Like that's the point of failure in the link there.
It's where the greatest degree of twist would be.
Yes. So instead of there being the greatest degree of pressure and twist at the foot driving into the ground in max P, it's through the ankle Achilles.
What's distributed. Area. So we have an IR shape of the pelvis, which is a force producing pelvis. We have the ability of the femur to turn inward. We have the ability of the tibia to turn inward. We have the ability to put the force through the ground at max propulsion where the greatest release of energy would actually take place.
Yeah. So that wave that you're talking about can't occur anymore.
Right.
So it's focal in that one spot and it hurts.
Correct. Okay. And it's unfortunate that everything else was E-hard and then we need a straight down force that's going through a twisted representation. That's why you get that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And you can see, and it's not always going to manifest in the Achilles. It could manifest in the knee. It could manifest in the hip. It could be in the neck. It could be their eye. It could be their vision.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
Let's not get too wild and crazy there.
Or, you know, right TMJ, you get that stuff sometimes.
Yeah, but now let's go to another scenario. Okay.
Sure.
So that's kind of like straight ahead, pushing straight down into the ground kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But what do we do? What do we do when we're moving on more an oblique axes? So this would be like a sharp cut or a change of direction. So if we're looking at the axial skeleton and what the axial skeleton has to do, now we're talking about rolling over one shoulder. So now we're rolling on an oblique axis, which again will match the actual helical angle that we're using to push into the ground. So these are the shape changes that we would need for changes of direction. And so this is why those types of roles then become important, because we can, again, we're using the same shape change through the ground. We're using the ground as the mobilization. We're using the internal dynamics. We're using the physical shape change that would be associated with a ground contact that you're going to put outside of your center of gravity into the ground and push away and change directions. It's the same thing.
And respecting structure and some of the foundational principles of the model when it comes to archetypes, you would want to shoulder roll differently for narrows versus wides.
Correct. Because they're going to roll on different axes.
Right. So a narrow shoulder roll is going to be one where you put your arm between your legs as you're going over, because it's on a more narrow axis. And a wider shoulder roll would be an arm reaching out to the side. And I can throw videos of that up in here as well. I'm creating an editing mess for myself, but I'll do it because these are good examples. Yeah.
But it will be useful. Yeah. And it's like, so, and again, you think about the archetypes and then certain types of structures that select people towards certain types of activities. So if we were like a 200 meter runner, okay, so they have to run, a curve, which is actually a series of cuts, but they're very shallow cuts. And so they're going to turn on a more vertical axis. So they're going to use a narrow type of a roll under most circumstances. And then if we're talking about, say, a basketball player or a football player that has to make sharper changes of direction, they are going to be on a much more horizontally oriented helical axis. They're going to perform a different type of roll, which, again, here's your editing nightmare of throwing in one of those for me so we can see the difference in how we would actually set the roll up, because That's going to determine what the outcome would be.
Okay, so let me clarify. Based on what I was saying earlier, I made it seem like you would only want to roll a narrow individual in a certain way. But you could roll, in your basketball example, you could roll for performance reasons. You could roll in a narrow basketball player with a wider roll. Is that what you're saying not really?
No. Okay. What I'm saying is the activity itself would select. But see, the body type would follow. The problem that we run into, okay, because of the number of people that are exposed to certain types of sports, we're talking about like the highest level where literally a body type is selected. Like, yes. Like you don't see too many wide ISA 200 meter sprinters.
Right. I would say none. Right? I would say you see none.
Now, if we're talking about high school athletes,
yeah.
Okay, because of the broad spectrum, we would see potentially short, stocky kids that are relatively fast for high school. Well, they get to do that kind of stuff. However, their turns are going to be different than we would see. And I always default back to Michael Johnson because he's the one that sort of pops into my head when it comes to like 200s and 400s.
Yeah.
It's like you look at his physical structure, he was very, very narrow, very vertical, very linear, and it even ran that way.
The gift of tremendous amounts of anterior orientation to just throw,
yeah,
throw exactly. force into the yeah. ground as quick as possible, yes. at a high yeah. rate.
Right. But he's going to perform more of like a narrow ISA variation of a shoulder roll.
Well, it's interesting you say that, like, because what you typically see in high school, you have the kids who are just fast, who end up on the track team that also are played for the football. And then in college, they end up being a tight end or a running back because they were wide. And sprinting never felt good for them, but they were fast. Right. So they were on the track team.
Yeah. So whenever we're having these discussions, the things that people need to recognize is that we're always talking about the extremes because they are just representative of the rules. People go against the rules. Like again, the short, stocky kid could be the fastest kid in his class, and therefore he becomes like a different type of an athlete. And then the higher the level he goes, he gets selected out. Kind of like you were saying, it's like, oh, your physical structure kind of puts you in this category. Right. Tim Tebow was not a typical structure for a drop back passer.
Yeah.
He looked like a running back or a tight end. In fact, he tried to come back and play as a tight end because he had the physical structure for that. Now, he didn't necessarily have the skill level because he didn't come up with those skills. And so it's much more difficult to develop them later on in life. Right. But his physical structure kind of pointed him towards like, hey, maybe you'd be, you know, a better tight end. Jim Kelly, quarterback Jim Kelly, was actually recruited as a linebacker at one point. That's how big a human being he was.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Penn State, I believe, which would be like linebacker university at the time. So, but again, it's like, so now had he trained in that direction, he could have become something else because he did have the foundational structure for it.
Right.
Yeah,
long-term athletic discovery.
Yeah, yeah, but but that's why we have all these different roles on different axes, because they fit into different categories at different times. It's like, so changes of direction are going to be on more obliques. The vertical dimensions, like vertical jumping, top speed sprinting, are going to be more like the roles are going to be on a more of a vertical axis.
Yeah.
Right? The shape changes that we need for IRs. It's like you take your Play-Doh and you roll it out and you make the long skinny tube. It's like, that's why you do the long axis rolls, is because I'm trying to create that shape change.
Yeah. So let's categorize things a little more clearly to kind of wrap things up here. We're talking about rolling. Typically people think of rolling, they think of like side lying, long axis rolling. What is that? If we could write down what that is seeking to accomplish, like what are the main things that I'm trying to go after with a long axis roll? Uh-huh.
Okay. So I'm trying to be able to move through middle propulsion, which means that I have to have a representation of early. I have to be able to access the IR shape to go through the middle of the roll, because that's where the strongest ground contact will be.
Yeah.
I still need an early and middle and a late, but I'm exposing myself to a longer, like anytime you're rolling, you're going to be exposing yourself to a longer representation of middle propulsion.
Sure.
I just need the two ends to create the shape to go there. And I need to be able to leave that position. And that's why, so if we were used to use an arm bar as an example, it's mm-hmm. it's a perfect representation of what we're talking about here. The longest duration in that type of a roll is through that middle propulsive phase, but we'd still have the two ends. So we can use the two ends to our advantage when we have deficits in either ER representation, because we got to start and finish. So we create those, right?
Right.
But it's always going to be a strong middle propulsive representation.
Okay. And now my more vertical rolling, like a dorsal sacral correct. Roll head to tail yes. along the spine, yes. basically those yes. are for what?
Pushing straight down into the ground and changing your center of gravity, right? So we're no longer just pushing into the ground. We're actually trying to leave the ground under this circumstance, right? So when you think about just rolling from head to tail,
yeah,
okay, your guts slam up into the diaphragm, and then they push down into the bottom of the pelvis. That's what you're doing. So this if you look at the literature, you'll see the concept called visceral pistoning.
Yeah, I was just going to say, though, I was just going to say it's helping you create the piston effect of the
crest. Correct. All right. So I don't have to worry so much about the turn that would be associated with moving through middle. I would be in middle, and then I have to create the internal dynamics that allow me to leave the ground.
Okay. That's helpful. And then the last one that we use as an example was the oblique shoulder roll scenarios. Correct.
These are the what oblique are those rolls.
For? And those okay. are four.
So, okay, when we're talking about rolling from hip to shoulder, that's going to be axial driven.
So backwards.
So backwards would be an inhalation bias, and then forwards over your shoulder is going to be an exhalation bias.
Okay.
So keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if I was to lie on my back and I'm going to drive a long diagonal roll, now I'm actually using the extremity to drive the axial skeleton. So now we're including the extremity, because in certain cases, I may not have the ability to position the extremity, but I can still work on the axial skeletal position. So this would be like the difference between a squat and a toe touch if we were doing an evaluation.
Right.
Right. So if I'm looking at a toe touch deficit, and I want to affect that toe touch deficit with a form of rolling, I'm going to use a hip to shoulder roll, because I'm emphasizing the proximal aspect in the axial skeleton. If I'm looking at a squat behavior, I need the extremity that's going to be included into that. And so I'm going to use an extremity driven type of roll.
Okay. So the oblique, the shoulder rolling, so that these side lying rolls creates more time and space in order to which to put IR down.
Correct.
The front to back rolling allows the ground to help you create the sort of pistoning effect of the guts.
Yes, sir.
In a vertical dimension.
Yes.
And then the oblique rolling
I still don't have like one thing that I'm honing in on as the reason to use it.
It's a bigger turn.
Okay. It's still the pistoning. It's still helping with the pistoning effect, but on an on an axis that you could help line up with someone's helical orientation.
Well, it would be, that would be that like the most effective role would be on your helical angle.
Right.
So if you, but it's the biggest turn, it's the, this is the biggest. So each one has a variation of turning.
Yeah. Right.
So sideline rolling doesn't have as big a turn as say the supine to prone and the prone to supine rolls, because those are bigger turns. There's a bigger gradient associated with the anterior posterior dimensions of the axial skeleton under that circumstance. Right.
Right.
So again, so middle P doesn't have the same gradient, like right. rolling through middle doesn't have the same gradient. But if I'm rolling on my helical axis, those are the biggest turns. That I need the biggest differential between the two sides to roll on a helical axis, because that's where the biggest turn is.
Okay. So what I could use as a stepwise progression for say like an athlete warming up could be a front to back, like a dorsal sacral roll straight up and down. And then something side-lying, and then finishing with like a walking shoulder roll, like just walking into a shoulder roll after they progressed to it, of course. But
But like
just a full on shoulder roll from standing, get up, be able to okay. So I think that's a useful representation. I think we really
if you had to generalize it, let's just say, here's the other cool thing. Let's just say you know nothing about this person.
Yeah.
Okay. You know nothing about them. We could take those three roles and we can use them diagnostically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. It's like all you have to be able to do is recognize where the deficit would be under the circumstance. And so we got somebody that's a lousy dorsal sacral roller. Okay. They can't move their guts up and down. So that gives us an idea of what shape that they actually have, right? If I can't roll like a log roll looks like a refrigerator, then you know you don't have the AP dimension and they can't create the IR that they need for middle propulsion. If they can't roll over shoulder, they can't turn.
Yeah, I'm thinking of athletes. There's a lot of narrow, very compressed, narrow, very high performing athletes that try to get to do dorsal sacral rolls, and the first move is just like under their back. It's just like
it looks like you're rolling a box.
Yeah, well, they can't even get their hips off the ground because they just go back and they're just flat,
There's, yeah. Exactly.
But that's
exactly
diagnostic too, because you know that lower posterior is probably closed for business because it's just flat as a pancake. But I think there was a lot of good nuggets and tips in this one, Bill.
I'm going to get sick to my stomach.
Just full of rolling nuggets. Well, we didn't wax too philosophical this time. We actually gave like pretty good examples and
it was pretty good practical stuff. Yes.
Okay. So, what should we, we haven't asked anyone for a question in the comments in a long time.
We haven't.
I want to know some of what people's favorite Saturday morning cartoons were.
Oh, wow.
I have some good ones.
Better than Hong Kong Sui?
Yeah. I mean, Hong Kong, those were always like, those were on at night. On Nickelodeon, those are always on at night.
Oh, so those are my Saturday morning cartoons.
Well, because you're old, Bill.
Well, Bugs Bunny Roadrunner, it has to be the greatest compendium of Saturday morning cartoons. Like hands down.
Yeah, those
without question.
Looney Tunes.
Without question. Looney Tunes. Because it was like 1953, I believe, is when they first came out.
It's very,
And they were huge when I was a kid.
Yeah, children's
huge
cartoons.
Huge when I was a kid.
40s even, I believe.
I think it was 1950. Don't quote me, but I think it's 1953.
The 50s is when like Disney was started, right? That was like the Disney time. That was when Disney World was
probably because
like
it was black. It was probably black and white,
something like that. Yeah.
And then the greatest fun fact of all time for the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner is that one person did all the voices.
Yeah.
Mel Blanc.
Mel Blanc. All the voices. The man, the myth, the legend, Mel Blanc.
Yes. Yes. And who did not like carrots? And yet he had to chew carrots.
They could have picked something else.
They tried. So there's an interview. There's an interview with Mel Blanc where they said, yeah, they tried rutabaga and like all different. They said they couldn't get the sound. They couldn't get the sound right. And so he literally had to chew carrots and he hated carrots.
That's fine. All right.
That's a commitment to your art, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Cool. See you on the network. Anyone that's still watching.
There you go. That's still there. Dale.